So we'll continue in the chapters on practices and perspectives, and then continue on the theme. This is like a middle path. There's a couple days we spent on natural path and how things progress on their own, and then this is sort of like on the actual middleness of the middle way and the importance of that middle way, Machima Padibata. This is the middle way of practice. It's also, the Buddha describes his teaching as a Machena Dhammadesana, a teaching by the middle. When we say middle, it's not just kind of a kind of split the difference and go for something coarse, but it's more like, how do we find a balance? The middle path is leading to the ending of suffering. It's important to get that context. Otherwise, we just end up sort of practicing a path very faithfully, very diligently, very devotedly. But you have to really be paying attention to both the nature of the path, but also the nature of the goal. So those are reflections to be taking into account. Yesterday, there was a long-ish discourse using the four bases of spiritual power as a theme. And this continues. Other more pithy passages make a similar point. This is from the Sutta Nipata. Sutta Nipata is a really beautiful collection of teachings. It tends to be a bit more poetic, a bit more terse, shorter. And by all scholarship, it's really one of the early layers of the Pali Canon. The abandoning both of sensual desires and of unhappiness, the dispelling of sloth, the warding off of anxieties, equanimity and mindfulness purified, with inspection of mental qualities swift in the forefront. That I call the gnosis of emancipation, the breaking open of ignorance. Not relishing feeling, inside or out, one living mindful in this way brings consciousness to a halt. So the sense of the purpose of the path, breaking open of ignorance with mindfulness, being mindful in living in this way, that sense of consciousness, that the mind that keeps seeking and keeps becoming comes to an end, a cessation. And not that we're forcing it to come to an end, because that doesn't work. That's another way of feeding it. But it's like, the most peaceful thing is just allowing things to cease. Opening up into that emptiness and spaciousness, silence. Sometimes calling it empty has a certain negative connotation, but it's that sense of empty of identification, that I-making, mind-making, the underlying tendency to conceit, ahankara, mankara, manhanusaya. These are the kind of underlying roots of our mind stream that keep seeking being and becoming. So then you realize you don't have to annihilate it or destroy it. You just watch it cease, and it brings consciousness to a halt. It's another one from Sutta Nipata. Subdue greed for sensual pleasures and see renunciation as rest. Let there be nothing grasped or rejected by you. Burn up what's before and have nothing for after. If you don't grasp at what's in between, you will go about calm. So that's quite similar to that quote that I had of Lopa Cha. The Dhamma is not found in either going forward or backward or stopping still. Non-abiding is where the essence of release is. And then seeing renunciation as rest. Oftentimes we see renunciation with horror. Oh my God, I've got to give it up. Really turning it around. Wow, what a relief, I can give that up. Just that shift of attention is really important. Although these passages portray the middle way as balancing two ends of a continuum, there are other instances where the Buddha defines the middle way as a precise approach that cuts through the continuum entirely. This is especially apparent in passages where he discusses the middle way in terms not of behavior or motivation, but of right view. The Buddha often stresses the radical importance of right view. And this is from the Anguttara Nikaya, the Ones. I do not envision any one other quality by which unarisen skillful qualities arise and arisen skillful qualities go to growth and proliferation, like right view. When a person has right view, unarisen skillful qualities arise and arisen skillful qualities go to growth and proliferation. That's just very immediate. Any questions? I don't want to just ramble along too long and people have questions. So. This is not a right view that is clung to as an orthodoxy, which is oftentimes like, I've got to make sure that I keep the right view that all formations are impermanent, and you keep sort of, you hold it as a view because it's an orthodoxy. But it's right view that leads to the ending of suffering. It is a correct perception of truth that leads to correct practice producing the right results. And the practice is not clung to and upheld, come what may. Instead, you stick to the practice as long as it's working. And as soon as it's not working, then you've got to figure it out. How do I find the way that allows the mind to become peaceful, to become clear, to be free from entanglement? And it's an ongoing exploration. Instead, one must continually align one's views and practice so as to cut through the misperception that all the options available to us can be expressed in an either or. That sense of, it's got to be one way or another. It's got to be right or wrong. It's got to be good or bad. And that's a habit that we have in our minds, and it's just the way our minds work. This helps provide a perspective that is more intuitive and centered in the present moment. This next sutta quote that I use is from Samyutta 12, sutta number 15. I think Ajahn Amaro has already mentioned it, but it bears a lot of repeating. Atsavati, then the Venerable Kacchana Gotta approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, right view. In what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view? This world, Kacchana, for the most part, depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. This world, Kajana, is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging, and adherence. But this one, with right view, does not become engaged and cling to that engagement and clinging, mental standpoint, adherence, underlying tendency. He does not take a stand about, quote-unquote, myself. He has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising, what ceases is only suffering ceasing. His knowledge about this is independent of others. It is in this way, Kacchana, that there is right view. All exists, Kacchana, this is one extreme. All does not exist, this is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle. The sutta goes on and goes into an exposition of dependent origination following the causal conditional process of experience. The importance of right view and the sense of the way the mind divides things into dualities of right and wrong, good and bad, like or dislike, want, not want, should, shouldn't. And upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. The word that the Buddha uses is apti. atita and natita. So it's like the sense of not so much a being, but a coming into being of anything. Could be personality, could be material things, whatever. Atita and natita are a very broad application. And then, yeah, for one who sees the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there's no notion of non-existence. Because one's recognized, you see things coming into being. And, okay, that doesn't come out of nothing. It doesn't come out of some sort of annihilation that's somehow pre-existing. No, there comes into being. And what comes into being is this causal process. There's no notion of non-existence in the sense of one can't get hooked or absolutely convinced that there is annihilation or buy into a nihilist view of the world or of the self, because things keep arising. And you see the arising and ceasing of things, then things can be more dynamically perceived and start paying attention to the process. And then when the Buddha says this, engagement, stuck in engagement and clinging, but what arises is only suffering arising, what ceases is only suffering ceases. It is phenomena, experience that arises and ceases, and phenomena arising and passing away. There's not an identity there, there's not a core of me and mine. It's just, yeah, things arising and ceasing. External, internal, coarse, refined, personal, impersonal. That's the way the world is. You say knowledge and vision are the way things truly are. And there's a great release in just being able to rest in that view, that perception. Okay, the next quote is from the Ittibuttaka. Bhikkhus, held by two kinds of views, some devas and human beings hold back and some overreach. Only those with vision see. And how, bhikkhus, do some hold back? Devas and humans enjoy being, delight in being, are satisfied with being. When Dhamma is taught to them for the cessation of being, their minds do not enter into or acquire confidence in it or settle upon it or become resolved upon it. Thus, bhikkhus, do some hold back. How, bhikkhus, do some overreach? Now, some are troubled, ashamed, and disgusted by this very same being, and they rejoice in the idea of non-being, asserting, inasmuch as this self, good sirs, when the body perishes at death, is annihilated and destroyed and does not exist after death, this is peaceful, this is excellent, this is reality. Thus, bhikkhus, do some overreach. How, bhikkhus, do those with vision see? Herein, a bhikkhu sees what has come to be as having come to be. Having seen it thus, he practices the course for turning away, for dispassion, for the cessation of what has come to be. Thus, bhikkhus, do those with vision see. So you start getting a sense of the subtlety of the Buddha's middle way. And the Buddha's articulating views that are not uncommon in the present day. The annihilation view, nihilist perspective. And in the same way, the tendency, of course, is delighting in being, satisfied with being. I mean, who, you know, there's a tendency to be enamored by that quality of being. Of course, it's all well and good when it goes your way, but then it doesn't always do that. And the reality is we're always going to be separated from all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me, which is, you know, one of the reflections that the Buddha encourages us to be doing on a daily basis. In the same thing, I am of the nature to age, I have not gone beyond aging, I have the nature to sicken, I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die, I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my kama, heir to my kama, born of my kama, related to my kama, abide, supported by my kama. Whatever kama I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So this sense of recognizing, yeah, I mean, there is an efficacy of action, but there's also a separation from all that one claims ownership of. And of course, what do we claim ownership of? This is my body, this is my personality, this is me, these are my feelings, these are my emotions, these are my views and opinions. And we're dismayed when they actually change. It's just everything follows the course of nature. Yeah.
In this context that you just read, it sounds like the middle way, non-self, dependent origination, everything is maybe equanimity and paramyata. Everything seems to be like the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's not very difficult. It's not far away from us. It's not far away from us. We've been hearing about it for a long time. There's that perplexity or that tendency to doubt or the tendency to look for something else or the resistance to truth, the resistance to reality. Mindfulness and clear comprehension, it's not just to be focused in the present moment, it's to be willing to accept the way things truly are. Oh, it's like this. Non posso meno. It's like this. So it's really important. It's very, very direct. And you know, of course, you know, the tools that the Buddha gives us are really, it's like learning how to use the tools skillfully. Dependent origination, tilakana, the three characteristics of existence, the Four Noble Truths. Really, how do we apply them? How do we live with them? How do we steep our hearts in them so that there is a relinquishment and a letting go? I'm not an annihilation, not a pushing away. It's just sort of like, it's a relief to let go. You know, we've been carrying around a lot of burdens. Okay. The act of clinging to views of being or non-being forms the basis for our misperception in life. When we hold to being, we foster a tendency to search for ways of furthering the gratification, comfort, pleasure of that being. When we hold to non-being, the swing goes in the direction of nihilism, fear, aversion to the quality of being. This is to state the case in a somewhat oversimplified way, but as we reflect and extrapolate from these two positions, we can see how they can give rise to a multitude of difficulties. The middleness of right view avoids other continuums as well, particularly the realm of philosophical or religious speculation. And this next quote is from Sangyutta 12, Sutta number 48. Atsavati, then a Brahman cosmologist, went to the Blessed One and on arrival exchanged courteous greetings with him. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "Now then, Master Gotama, does everything exist?" "Everything exists," is the senior form of cosmology, Brahman. "Then, Master Gotama, does everything not exist?" "Everything does not exist," is the second form of cosmology, Brahman. "Then is everything a oneness?" "Everything is a oneness," is the third form of cosmology, Brahman. "Then is everything a plurality?" "Everything is a plurality," is the fourth form of cosmology, Brahman. Avoiding these two extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma via the middle. From ignorance as a requisite condition come fabrications. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense media. From the sixth sense media as a requisite condition comes contact. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging / sustenance, upadana. From clinging / sustenance As a requisite condition comes becoming. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as a requisite condition, then aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair come into play. Such is the origination of this entire mass of stress and suffering. Now, from the remainderless fading and cessation of that very ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the six sense media. From the cessation of the six sense media comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging / sustenance. From the cessation of clinging / sustenance comes the cessation of becoming. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair all cease. Such is the cessation of this entire mass of stress and suffering. Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent, just as if he were to place upright what was overturned, to reveal what was hidden, to show the way to one who was lost, or to carry a lamp into the dark so that those with eyes could see forms, in the same way has Master Gotama, through many lines of reasoning, made the Dhamma clear. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, to the Dhamma and to the community of Sangha. May Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge, from this day forward for life. That's, to me, a very beautiful sutta. And, you know, I think sometimes when you hear the 12 links of dependent origination being recited in their forward way, in their backward way, it's easy to just start to glaze over. This is too much. Or, you know, what's it all mean anyway? But I think just paying attention to this condition process and paying attention, trying to get an inside look at what are some of the causes that we are putting into place, both for the coming into being of suffering as well as for the actual ending of suffering. Because it's not as if we're all necessarily destined to be on this cycle towards suffering all the time. Both of those go side by side. The ending of suffering is always given the same play. We just forget to look that far. We've already got bored with the first 12. We forget to look at it closely. Also, just thinking of the way Ajahn Chah, making it very practical, because sometimes he said, you try too hard to know every single link, every single experience, every single piece of the puzzle of Paticca-samuppada. And he said, really, it's much more like falling from a tree. You don't really have to count every branch as you're going past them. You just have to know when you hit the bottom, it's going to hurt. And how do I avoid that? How do I work with that? Yeah.
How do you understand the cessation of consciousness in this passage?
I think one of the things, to me, and I don't have any support from the suttas, but cessation of consciousness is a cessation through awareness and understanding, knowledge, than that movement of mind toward another object to pay attention, to invest in as an object of interest. Just being able to stay with awareness, just to be present with awareness. Yeah.
That really fits in with when you look at the etymology of vijnana, of divided knowing.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I didn't think of that. Yeah. We is to divide. Jnana is knowledge. So that knowledge, that is divided. So we keep dividing it into subject and object, internal, external, mine and other. So when the mind just stays with just being with the knowing, it's just this, you know, it's like the Thai forest tradition, is you're staying with Bhutto. Think, wow, that's really, isn't that kindergarten stuff? But you realize, oh wow, that cuts through so much. Yeah.
How is awareness not consciousness?
You know, I mean, part of it's English language. Using the word consciousness, there is an investment in a something, like a being, a consciousness, or a solidity, or something that's measurable. And that's one thing that, you know, actually Western science hasn't been able to measure, is consciousness, for all of its attempts to measure everything else. So using other language helps to sort of see what, just being aware of something, is the functioning of consciousness. It's not a thing. It's a function. Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
How could happen the cessation of consciousness?
Because we don't reinvent it or reinvest in it or re-reify it, make it solid, then it ceases to have that solidity.
It means that we don't make it a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, we're addicted to things. I've got my things, you know. Okay, continuing on. So there's another sutta. Sangyutta 12 is the Nidana Sangyutta, the section on conditionality. Atsavati. Then the wanderer Timbaruka approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to him, "How is it, Master Gotama? Are pleasure and pain created by oneself?" "Not so, Timbaruka," the Blessed One said. "Then, Master Gotama, are pleasure and pain created by another?" "Not so, Timbaruka," the Blessed One said. "How is it then, Master Gotama? Are pleasure and pain created both by oneself and by another?" "Not so, Timbaruka," the Blessed One said. "Then, Master Gotama, have pleasure and pain arisen fortuitously, being created neither by oneself nor by another?" "Not so, Timbaruka," the Blessed One said. "How is it then, Master Gotama? Is there no pleasure and pain?" "It is not that there is no pleasure and pain, Timbaruka. There is pleasure and pain." "Then is it that Master Gotama does not know and see pleasure and pain?" "It is not that I do not know and see pleasure and pain, Timbaruka. I know pleasure and pain. I see pleasure and pain." "Whether you are asked, 'How is it, Master Gotama, are pleasure and pain created by oneself? Or are they created by another? Or are they created by both? Or are they created by neither?' In each case you say, 'Not so, Timbaruka.' When you are asked, 'How is it then, Master Gotama? Is there no pleasure and pain?' You say, 'It is not that there is no pleasure and pain, Timbaruka. There is pleasure and pain.' When asked, 'Then is it that Master Gotama does not know and see pleasure and pain?' You say, 'It is not that I do not know and see pleasure and pain, Timbaruka. I know pleasure and pain. I see pleasure and pain.' Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One explain pleasure and pain to me. Let the Blessed One teach me about pleasure and pain. Timbaruka, if one thinks the feeling and the one who feels it are the same, then one asserts with reference to one existing from the beginning. Pleasure and pain are created by oneself. I do not speak thus." And then in a previous sutta, it answers a similar question. When one asserts thus, this amounts to eternalism. "But Timbaruka, if one thinks the feeling is one and the one who feels it is another, then one asserts with reference to one stricken by feeling, pleasure and pain are created by another. Neither do I speak thus." And then similarly, in a previous sutta, the Buddha answers a similar question. When one asserts thus, this amounts to annihilationism. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle. With ignorance as condition, volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as condition, consciousness comes to be. And then through the whole sequence of dependent origination, such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes cessation of volitional formations, with the cessation of volitional formations, cessation of consciousness, and then through the whole series of links. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. When this was said, the naked ascetic Timbaluka said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent, and I go for refuge to Master Gotama and to the Dhamma and to the Bhikkhu Sangha. From today, let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life." It's a good description of using feeling vedana as a doorway in. One of the fundamentals of experience is vedana, or the tangible. Consciousness, a bit slippery, subject to interpretation or very quick assumptions, but with pleasure and pain, that is quite tangible. And of course, that vedana is the link in dependent origination that precedes tanha, with pleasure, pain, neither pain nor pleasure. Then there's a direct causal process or conditioning process for the arising of tanha, of desire, craving, and then the whole cascade of upadana, clinging and becoming and birth. But it's a good doorway in for recognizing the conditioned nature of our experience. Okay, the next sutta is Samyutta 12, sutta number 67, is similarly Nidana Samyutta. On one occasion, Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahakotita were staying near Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Then in the evening, arising from his seclusion, Venerable Mahakotita went to Venerable Sariputta and on arrival exchanged courteous greetings with him. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to Venerable Sariputta, and there's actually many suttas with exchanges between Sariputta and Mahakotita. They're both considered arahants. I mean, Sariputta, of course, an arahant, but also Venerable Mahakotita is considered an arahant. But he delights in playing the devil's advocate and really questioning Sariputta closely in many aspects of Dhamma. So you get some very interesting exchanges. I think one of the ways to clarify one's own understanding, both for oneself as well as for others that are there listening, is playing the devil's advocate a bit to try to see how Sariputta is going to answer this one. So he poses some things that, on a certain level, because he's considered an arahant, he would be so well established in right view that he wouldn't be asking that for his own benefit, but he's asking it for the benefit of others. "Now tell me, Sariputta, my friend, are aging and death self-made or other-made, or both self-made and other-made, or without self-making or other-making? Do they arise spontaneously?" "It's not the case, Kutita, my friend, that aging and death are self-made, that they are other-made, that they are both self-made and other-made, or that without self-making or other-making, they arise spontaneously. However, from birth as a requisite condition comes aging and death. A similar exchange continues through the other links of conditioned arising." "It's amazing, friend Sariputta, it's astounding, friend Sariputta, how well that was said by the Venerable Sariputta. I rejoice in Venerable Sariputta's good statements with regard to these 36 topics. If a monk teaches the Dhamma for the sake of disenchantment, dispassion, and cessation, With regard to aging and death, he deserves to be called a monk who is a speaker of Dhamma. If he practices for the sake of disenchantment, dispassion, and cessation with regard to aging and death, he deserves to be called a monk who practices the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma. If, through disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, and a lack of clinging or sustenance, with regard to aging and death, he is released, then he deserves to be called a monk who has attained Nibbana in the here and now. And of course, that whole sequence goes through all of the links of dependent origination, just the sense of both teaching and practicing for the sake of disenchantment, dispassion, and cessation. That's the essence of the path, and that's what takes one to one's goal. The need for a gradual path of practice becomes clearer as we recognize the many diversions that can pull us off the path. Just like those speculations about self and view and other and world and not world and being of a oneness or a plurality. I mean, those are very familiar religious doctrines that are all through religious spiritual history. And the Buddha really cuts through that and comes to a place of pay attention to experience and the cessation of experience. Okay, the need for a gradual path of practice becomes clearer as we recognize the many diversions that can pull us off the path. Without a clearly laid out step-by-step training, it would be very easy to wander haphazardly, looking for some ill-defined spiritual denouement. Denouement is a neat ending of things. Or to immerse oneself in a series of nebulous and vague practices that don't really lead anywhere other than to more confusion and difficulty. By relying on the middle path, we can directly cut through the internal and external sources of confusion that distract the mind from realizing Nibbana. This will ultimately require a radical letting go or relinquishment, but this is precisely what this gradual path and its middle way are preparing us for. So again, this aspect of the path as being a natural path, a middle path, being a path at all, a gradual path, the importance of there being ways of practice, ways of being, ways of living, ways of contemplating and investigating that we can rely on and cultivate and develop so that we do lay a foundation for understanding and penetration. Although there is a gradual path, it does have a purpose, and it's preparing us to realize the purpose of the middle way. I go on to the next chapter, and the theme of the next chapter is sudden penetration, so that it's contrasting that to the gradual. Any questions? Yeah.
So there are lots of mention about cutting through. And you also mentioned about cutting through the buttholes. And yes, I also do have a tendency to underestimate the benefit of buttholes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Would you elaborate a little more about that cutting through and the buttholes?
I think one of the things is just gaining the confidence in that clarity of awareness and the presence of attention. Right there, one is experiencing a moment of clarity, of stillness, of spaciousness. Unfortunately, what we do is then go on to the next thing, or we think, must be something else. And so then we don't explore that stillness or that cessation or that peace. It's encouraging ourselves to explore that, the spaciousness and stillness, and silence of cessation. Not as an annihilation, but as a very natural expression of awareness and attention. So then, butto is a doorway in, sound of silence, lumpa samedo is a doorway in, mindfulness of breathing is a doorway in, anything, loving kindness, a doorway, everything is a doorway in if we use it skillfully. Yes?
On that same thread. I don't know from my experience, sometimes when I rest in the awareness for a long time. It feels very peaceful and nice and calm and pure. Then it's, I don't know, that just sounds like, so what? I mean, it's like...
Yeah.
It's just nothing.
Well, that is doubt, isn't it?
Okay.
The other day I read one of the suttas that was looking at the causal conditioning process, starting from ignorance, but then tracking back and say there are causes and conditions for ignorance. And the first cause and condition for avijja, ignorance, is the five hindrances. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, skeptical doubt. Then just starting to look more clearly at the content or the feeling when we're bored or we're restless. Those are like just, because we know these five hindrances, oh, this is really Buddhist meditation 101. But it has real big implications. You apply it on another level of investigating the content and experience of the mind. So it's a really helpful tool for seeing, you know, how to, just recognizing some. Oh, that is doubt. Oh, I'm getting caught in doubt. And then it becomes more concrete rather than personalizing it as, I don't think there's a way out of this. I don't think this is right. I don't know about this whole sort of Buddhism stuff anyway. What are they talking about? Because the track is very compelling, because that's what doubt does. In order to invest in doubt, we've got to sort of believe in it at least a little bit. So it's like really bringing it into question and investigating it. But those five hindrances are really, really important tools for investigating the content of the mind that is taking us away from stillness and clarity. It's not just on a samatha level or a mindfulness level. It's on a real deep wisdom level as well. Yes?
In terms of that, so what?
Yeah.
What I've found, you know, helpful is that when one is able to use, you know, that something like Buddha, you know, an experience, something happens. Yeah. And when one is able to respond to that with awareness, and the result is peace, I find it very helpful to notice that and compare it to what usually happens.
Right.
And then that pretty much, that's direct experience and tends to answer the question, so what?
Because
it'd be like, well, if it wasn't Buddha, it would be suffering.
Yeah. It's just helpful to, you know, trying to shine a light on it in different ways so that we get to understand it, get a handle on it, and not get entangled. Okay, almost 7 o'clock. We'll start a new chapter tomorrow.